Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 191. It's Monday, December 19th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, from being in the viral soup that we're in, we're seeing a rise in COVID. Now, COVID has actually caused more deaths than both the flu and RSV, although the flu and RSV tend to hit younger people a lot harder than COVID does, but all three of those hit the elderly and other vulnerable people quite hard. And as far as COVID goes, while we have reached the low of around 300 deaths per day, not very good, but the lowest we've gotten to in over about a year and a half, we're back up over 400 deaths per day from COVID. So be careful out there, people. Okay, well, let's start with some good news from COVID. This is from The Hill. COVID vaccines save 3.2 million U.S. lives, researchers say. The COVID-19 vaccines saved more than 3 million American lives over a two-year period, according to new research from the Commonwealth Fund. The first coronavirus vaccine in the U.S. was administered in December 2020. Since then, healthcare workers have put more than 655 million doses into the arms of Americans, with 80% of the population having at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. The Commonwealth Fund estimated the vaccines prevented more than 18.5 million hospitalizations and 3.2 million deaths from December 2020 to last month. Researchers added the vaccines also prevented 120 million more COVID-19 infections and saved the U.S. more than $1 trillion. Next up from The Hill, have some good news on the new bivalent COVID boosters. Updated COVID booster prevents majority of hospitalization, CDC data show. New data from the CDC show the bivalent COVID-19 booster shot was effective at reducing the risk of hospitalization and emergency room visits by at least 50%. Two separate reports released by the CDC last Friday offer some of the first evidence of the booster's effectiveness against hospitalizations and medical encounters. One study found a bivalent COVID-19 booster dose reduced the risk of hospitalization by 57% in adults over the age of 18 compared with being unvaccinated, and by 45% compared with being unboosted. Previous data from the CDC suggested that bivalent boosters provide a modest degree of protection against asymptomatic infection among adults compared with the receipt of 2, 3, or 4 doses of monovalent vaccines only. Bivalent COVID-19 booster vaccines were developed to improve protection against circulating Omicron subvariants and waning immunity from monovalent vaccine-conferred protection over time. The boosters were especially effective in adults over the age 65, who are at the highest risk for severe COVID-19-associated illness. A second report showed the bivalent shot was 84% effective at preventing hospitalizations compared to people who were unvaccinated, and 74% effective compared with people who received at least 2 doses of the monovalent vaccines. Everyone, especially those 65 and older, who are at the highest risk for severe COVID-19 illness, should receive a bivalent booster dose as soon as they are eligible and to consider masking in indoor public spaces to maximize protection against COVID-19 hospitalization this winter, the authors of the second report wrote. Both analyses were conducted between September and November, during which time multiple Omicron subvariants, including BA5 and the combination of BAQ1 and BAQ1.1, have been the dominant strains. Administration officials are pushing for more Americans to get the latest shots in an effort to stem a new surge of infections, which would come on top of an early and particularly hard-hitting flu season and high levels of RSV. But uptake is still extremely low, even among the most vulnerable. Only about 16% of adults over age 18 and 36% of people over age 65 have received an updated shot. Still not too late, folks. If you haven't received your booster and you're eligible, go for it. Oh, and some more good COVID news, this from the Hill. White House to resume program sending free COVID tests by mail. The Biden administration is restarting its program to send free COVID-19 testing kits through the U.S. mail to any household that requests them. The White House last Thursday said households can begin ordering a total of 4 at-home tests from covidtests.gov. Again, that's covidtests.gov website, to be mailed directly to them for free, regardless of how many tests they have ordered previously. The tests will start to ship out the week of December 19th. The White House first began sending out the kits last January during the peak of the Omicron wave, but the program was halted at the beginning of September due to a lack of funding from Congress. Administration officials at the time indicated they were concerned the stockpile of tests would run out before the winter. By the time the program ended, the federal government distributed an estimated 600 million tests. Now the program is restarting as part of the White House's broader winter preparedness plan. According to a senior administration official, leftover American Rescue Plan money is being repurposed to purchase and distribute additional tests. Okay, well, while we continue to get good news about the effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines, the anti-vax movement has made a dent, and this next story gets to that from The Hill. Survey finds growing opposition to school vaccine mandates for measles. A growing number of parents oppose requirements for routine vaccinations against measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR, in order for children to attend school, according to a new survey released last Friday by the Kaiser Family Foundation. The survey found 35% of parents of children under age 18 oppose school vaccine requirements. This is up from 23% in 2019. All states in the District of Columbia require children to be vaccinated against certain diseases, including measles and rubella, in order to attend public schools, though exemptions are allowed in certain circumstances. The increasing opposition comes on the heels of heated partisan fights over COVID-19 vaccine mandates and a distrust of public health authorities. The survey found 28% of all adults said the parents should be able to choose not to vaccinate their children, even if it creates a health risk for others. This is up from 16% in 2019, so from 16 to 28%. Much like with COVID-19 vaccines, the growing opposition stems largely from people who identify as Republican or lean Republican. According to the survey, 44% said parents should be able to opt out of the MMR childhood vaccines, up from 20% in 2019. In contrast, 88% of Democrats and those who lean Democratic said they support requiring the vaccines for public school students, mostly unchanged from 86% in 2019. But the shift seems more about opposition to mandates and less about the shots themselves. Today, 85% of the public and 80% of parents said the benefits of the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines outweigh the risks. Little change from 2019, when 88% of the public and 83% of parents felt that way. Among parents who have not gotten vaccinated for COVID-19, 63% said their parents should be able to decide not to vaccinate their children, even if that creates health risks for children and adults. About 1 in 4 unvaccinated adults said the risks of the MMR vaccine outweigh the benefits. But even among that group, there were still 70% who said the benefits of childhood MMR vaccines outweigh the risks. Aside from childhood MMR vaccines, the survey also asked about the bivalent COVID-19 booster shot. About 22% of adults said they have already gotten the recommended bivalent booster shot, while 16% said they will get it as soon as they can. The bivalent booster targets both the original and Omicron COVID-19 strains that has been available since September. Among those age 65 and older, the most vulnerable age group, about one-third said they don't think they need it. A similar share said they don't think the benefit of the updated booster is worth it. About 23% of vaccinated adults age 65 and older say they have not gotten the updated booster because they have been too busy or have not had the time to get it yet. Amid reports about a surge in flu and RSV cases among young children, parents are now at least as likely to worry about their children getting sick from those illnesses as from COVID-19, a sign that COVID-19 is no longer a singular concern for parents and is increasingly becoming part of the normal seasonal virus cycle. Roughly half of parents say they are at least somewhat worried that their children will get sick from RSV at 56%, the flu 51%, and COVID-19 47%. So this is pretty accurate, and this is true as far as children's risk. RSV and flu hit kids proportionally more than COVID does with kids. So this makes sense, although, of course, with adults, COVID is definitely still outweighs RSV and the flu as killers. And either way, science says COVID-19 vaccines are safe, effective, cost-effective for both kids and adults. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Well, folks, China has made a pretty quick reversal of its zero COVID policy, and things are opening up fast, and the government has definitely moved from war on COVID to COVID optimism, which, of course, is going to be a difficult transition no matter how they do it, but I suspect that we're seeing the first signs of things becoming really bad. Two stories on that. First up from Reuters, medical staff in China's hospitals say COVID-19 ripping through their ranks. A growing number of China's doctors and nurses are catching COVID-19, and some have been asked to keep working, as people showing mostly moderate symptoms throng hospitals and clinics, according to medical staff and dozens of posts on social media. Health experts say China's sudden loosening of strict COVID rules is likely to trigger a surge in severe cases in coming months, and hospitals in big cities are already showing signs of strain. Health officials have been recommending that people with mild COVID symptoms quarantine at home and have also said most of the cases reported in the country are mild or asymptomatic. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Our hospital is overwhelmed with patients. There are 700, 800 people with fever coming in every day, said a doctor surnamed Li at a tertiary hospital in Sichuan province. We are running out of medicine stocks for fever and cold, now waiting for delivery from our suppliers. A few nurses at the fever clinic were tested positive. There aren't any special protective measures for hospital staff, and I believe many of us will soon get infected, Li added. A nurse at another hospital in Chengdu said, I was swamped with nearly 200 patients with COVID symptoms last night. Ben Cowling, an epidemiologist at Hong Kong University, said insufficient medical resources to cope with an overload of COVID cases contributed to a surge in deaths in Hong Kong when infections peaked there earlier this year, and he warned the same was going to happen in China. One of the reasons we had such a high mortality rate in Hong Kong is because we simply don't have enough hospital resources to cope in a surge, and unfortunately, that is what is going to happen in about 1 or 2 months' time in the mainland, Cowling said. Some hospitals in Beijing have up to 80% of their staff infected, but many of them are still required to work due to staff shortages, a doctor in a large public hospital in Beijing told Reuters, adding he has spoken to his peers at other big hospitals in the capital. All operations and surgeries have been canceled at his hospital unless the patient is, quote, dying tomorrow, he said, declining to be named due to the sensitivity of the subject. Several doctors from Wuhan province's top public hospital, Tongji, have also tested positive for COVID-19, but since Sunday have not been allowed to take leave, a pharmaceutical sales representative with direct knowledge of the matter told Reuters, declining to be named as the information is not public. They have to stay at work while they're sick, said the person who regularly visits the hospital and spoke to its doctors recently. So now with China's COVID optimism strategy, they're not tracking asymptomatic cases. They're only counting ones with severe disease. So it pretty makes following the tracking, which is unreliable anyways, completely unreliable. But one way that you can sort of get an idea about how bad it is go to the crematoriums and the funeral parlors. So we got a story on that next from Medical Express. Beijing crematorium strain under China COVID wave. Workers at Beijing crematorium said last Friday they are overwhelmed as China faces a surge in COVID cases that authorities warn could hit undeveloped rural hinterland during upcoming public holidays. COVID-19 is spreading rapidly across China after 3 years of strict containment measures ended last week, with health authorities now admitting the true scale of the outbreak is, quote, impossible to track. China's top COVID response body on Friday urged local governments to step up monitoring and treatment services for people returning to rural hometowns to visit family for upcoming New Year's Day and Lunar New Year celebrations. The latter is the world's largest annual migration, with 3 years of pent-up demand due to prolonged zero COVID-19 domestic travel restrictions waiting to explode. State media and Chinese health experts have downplayed the severity of Omicron, said expert Zhang Nanxing, recently saying that COVID should be called the, quote, coronavirus cold. But millions of unvaccinated elderly people remain vulnerable, and there have been widespread shortages of antigen tests and fever medicines in shops. Two Beijing funeral homes confirmed they were operating 24 hours a day and offering same-day cremation services to keep up with the recent surge in demand, despite official data registering no new COVID deaths since December 4th. We're being worked to the bone. Over 10 of our 60 staff are positive for COVID, but we have no choice. It's been so busy lately, one crematorium staffer said. Another Beijing crematorium said that there was a week-long waiting list for a spot. A recent study by researchers at the University of Hong Kong estimated China could experience about 1 million COVID deaths this winter without timely intervention, such as a fourth dose booster vaccination and social restrictions. China has only reported 9 official deaths from COVID since mid-November, despite logging more than 10,000 daily infections since then. There were no COVID deaths reported nationwide between May 28th and November 19th. In the earliest Wuhan outbreak, many deaths of the COVID-positive patients went unreported due to strict national criteria for classifying COVID-related deaths, Chinese media reported at the time. Managers of 5 nursing homes told Chinese media last Thursday that they were unable to procure antigen tests or medicines due to shortages and had no emergency plans for a wide-scale outbreak. Videos of COVID patients sitting on stools receiving saline drips outside crowded hospitals have also been going viral on social media in recent days. Looks like COVID is coming to China in force. Okay, well, I wanted to do a follow-up on the ongoing measles outbreak in the Columbus, Ohio area. This from MedPage Today. Ohio measles outbreak cases jumped to 74. measles cases continue to rise in central Ohio, with total cases hitting 74 this week, up from about 50 reported last week, according to Columbus Public Health. Our investigation has found out the majority of cases, 56 of 74 cases, are old enough for at least one dose of MMR, but their parents have chosen not to have them vaccinated. Unfortunately, we are not seeing an uptick in MMR vaccine uptake despite the outbreak, and we do anticipate that cases will continue to grow before it begins to subside. Many of these children have been very sick and require hospitalization. We've had 26 hospitalizations so far, which is a reminder that measles is a very serious disease and can make children very sick. Children can suffer a variety of complications, including dehydration, pneumonia, and neurological conditions like encephalitis. Measles vaccine eligibility does not begin until 12 months of age, according to the CDC. Well, in the U.S., the overall death rate has come down a bit, but is still higher than it was prior to COVID. We haven't completely recovered from the excess mortality. This from the Associated Press. U.S. deaths fell this year, but not to pre-COVID levels. The number of U.S. deaths dropped this year, but there are still more than there were before the coronavirus hit. Preliminary data through the first 11 months of the year indicates 2022 will see fewer deaths than the previous two COVID-19 pandemic years. Current reports suggest deaths may be down 3% from 2020 and about 7% versus 2021. If the decline does hold, it will still be a far cry from where the nation was before the coronavirus appeared. This year's count is likely to end up at least 13% higher than what it was in 2019. COVID-19 will end up as the nation's third leading cause of death this year, just as it was in 2020 and 2021, behind the perennial leaders, heart disease and cancer. So the excess mortality that's come about, whether directly from COVID or its indirect cause, I mean, we've also been seeing a rise in the so-called deaths of despair. And COVID-19, of course, can accelerate that, but that was a pattern that was happening for many, many years prior to the pandemic. Okay, well, next up, an interesting story on cancer screening, this from CNN. Only 14% of diagnosed cancers in the U.S. are detected by screening, report says. A small proportion, 14.1% of all diagnosed cancers in the United States, are detected by screening with a recommended screening test, according to a new report. The remaining diagnosed cancers tend to be found when someone has symptoms or seeks imaging or medical care for other reasons, suggests the report posted by researchers at the nonprofit research organization NORC at the University of Chicago. I was shocked that only 14% of cancers were detected by screening. I think for many people, we talk so much about cancer screening that we imagine that's how all cancers are diagnosed. We talk about mammograms and colonoscopies all the time, said Carolyn Pearson, an author of the report and senior vice president at the organization. Yet, the vast majority of cancer types don't have screening tests available, Pearson said. The technical report notes that just four types of cancer, breast, cervical, colorectal, and lung, have screening tests recommended for use by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. And the percent of cancers detected by screening varies across those types. 61% of breast cancers, 52% of cervical cancers, 45% of colorectal cancers, and only 3% of lung cancers. The report also includes data on prostate cancer, even though screening for prostate cancer is not broadly recommended. And the data suggests that 77% of prostate cancers are detected by screening. The report, which has not been published in a peer-reviewed journal, is based on data from 2017, but Pearson said that since then, studies have shown that the rates of cancer screening declined during the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. She suspects that the percentage of cancer detected by screening could now be even lower than what was found in this new report. Dr. Otis Brawley, an oncology professor at Johns Hopkins University, said he was not surprised by the findings in the new report, especially because some cancer screening tests can be improved on in their performance. Everyone has been led to believe that screening is better than it actually is, said Brawley, who was not involved in the new report. We need to invest in research to try to find better tests. In the case of breast cancer, for instance, clinical trials tell us screening prevents 25% of those destined to die of breast cancer from dying of breast cancer, he said. In the U.S., about 60% of women aged 50 to 70 even get screened. That means we can only prevent about 15% of the deaths destined to occur. It also means a lot of patients are diagnosed with cancer after a negative screening test. People in the United States could benefit from following cancer prevention measures, such as getting screened and maintaining a healthy lifestyle. But the public can also benefit from better screening tests themselves, Brawley said. We spend so much time pushing screening and pushing screening tests. Yes, they do save lives, but we need to be able to save more lives, he said. We need better. And of course, I think the really the most important message in this, underlying all this, is that prevention is better than testing and treatment. A lot of cancer, potentially up to around half, is preventable by lifestyle factors. And that's more than what's detected through testing. So obviously you should do both, but if you really want to get at cancer rates, you've got to do primary prevention. Prevent it in the first place. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, now let's turn to a couple of healthcare stories. First up from the Hill, out-of-pocket health spending rises at highest rate since 1985. U.S. spending on healthcare grew by 2.7% to reach a total of $4.3 trillion in 2021, or around $12,900 per person, according to new figures from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Although this growth was slower than the increase of 10.3% in 2020, out-of-pocket healthcare spending accounted for 10% of the overall share last year and increased by 10.4%, a rate not seen since 1985. In comparison, out-of-pocket spending fell by 2.6% in 2020 amid the COVID-19 pandemic, as Americans put off doctor's appointments and other health services. The number of uninsured individuals in the United States decreased for the second year in a row in 2021, thanks to increased enrollment in Medicaid and private health insurance, authors note. Roughly 8% of Americans, or 26 million people, are currently living without health insurance, marking an all-time low. However, even with insurance, Americans may find themselves paying out-of-pocket for deductibles, copays, and services that are not covered. The United States also spends more on healthcare than any other healthy country, while costs of care continue to climb. Most Americans receive their health coverage from their employers, meaning that they have little say in what services are covered. This lack of choice can limit competition and drive up prices. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Service data show spending on health care by private businesses rose by 6.5% in 2021, compared with 2.9% decline seen in 2020. The majority of this increase was driven by contributions to employer-sponsored private health insurance premiums. So everything is going up, from premiums to deductibles and copays, and for services that are not covered, or you have to cover it all if you want to do it at all. On the whole, Americans' health is also getting worse. 42% of the population is obese, and 74% are overweight, CDC data show, while Americans have the highest rates of chronic disease, like diabetes and heart disease, among wealthy nations. It seems that we could do better.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, this next story accents the fact that in American healthcare, you don't necessarily get what you pay for. This from Medical Express. Higher prices don't imply better care for patients undergoing joint replacement. The prices that insurers negotiate for total joint replacement Procedures vary widely according to type of insurer and aren't associated with conventional measures of healthcare quality, according to a study in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research. Total joint replacement is the most common in-hospital surgery performed for U.S. patients older than 65 years old. It's predicted that the number of these procedures, most commonly knee or hip replacement, will continue to increase year after year, making them a key driver of rising healthcare costs. In general, prices for the procedures are negotiated by insurance companies and the federal government, rather than being set by individual surgeons or hospitals. We found that the differences in negotiated prices across the five surveyed payer types for the same total joint replacement procedures varied by nearly $60,000, the researchers report. Private insurers paid the most, Medicaid paid the least, regardless of quality measures. There was no correlation between the average negotiated price and any of the four measures of the quality of care. The total joint replacement complication rate, the need for hospital readmission after surgery, patients' rating of their care, and overall hospital performance score. This just shows the disconnection between a so-called, you know, market-driven system. It's profit-driven, and unfortunately, the price setting has little to do with either the quality of the service. And now that in U.S. Metropolitan areas, 90% of those metropolitan areas are considered to be highly concentrated healthcare markets, which means there isn't a lot of competition. Okay, well, let's switch gears a bit and do a couple stories on how climate change is fueling health problems, public health problems, worldwide and in our own neighborhoods. First up from Medical Express, climate change fueling cholera surge, says World Health Organization. Climate change is fueling a global cholera upsurge, the WHO said last Friday, warning the situation was compounded by vaccine shortages and will only worsen unless it's stamped out soon. The World Health Organization is responding to cholera outbreaks in 29 countries, including Haiti, which has more than 1,200 confirmed cases, more than 14,000 suspected cases, and more than 280 reported deaths. This last week, Haiti received almost 1.2 million doses of oral cholera vaccines, but the WHO said the vaccine stockpiles are extremely low and that manufacturers were not enthusiastic about producing a vaccine chiefly aimed at some of the poorest countries in the world. If we don't control the outbreak now, the situation will get worse and worse, Philippe Barbosa, the WHO's team lead on cholera, told reporters in Geneva. He said fatality rates are extremely high for most of the countries for which the UN Health Agency has data. Cholera is contracted from a bacterium that is generally transmitted through contaminated food or water. It causes diarrhea and vomiting and can be especially dangerous for young children. The factors which drive cholera are the same: poverty, vulnerability of people, and people who do not have access to clean water, Barbosa said. These are amplified by conflict, humanitarian crises, and natural disasters, which reduce access to drinking water. But this year we have a factor which is even more important, the direct impact of climate change. With a succession of major droughts, unprecedented floods in certain parts of the world, and cyclones which have amplified most of these pandemics, he said. Barbosa said that while there have been big epidemics in certain countries before, they had not happened simultaneously as now. Although cholera can kill within hours, it can be treated with simple oral rehydration and antibiotics for more severe cases. But many people lack timely access to such treatment. Outbreaks can be prevented by ensuring access to clean water and improving surveillance. It is not acceptable in the 21st century to have people dying of a disease that is very well known and very easy to treat, said Barbosa. Barbosa said that making those doses was not very attractive to manufacturers as it's, quote, a vaccine for poor countries. But he insisted that the mortality rate could be reduced by prioritizing timely access to medical aid. The fight against cholera is not lost. We can win it, he said. And this just brings back such memories. I remember taking an international health course in the 80s, back when I was in graduate school, and talking about how crazy it is that you can treat diarrheal diseases, which a cholera is a major killer of diarrheal diseases, with basically an oral rehydration pack, which is a little bit of sugar and some electrolytes.
you know, costs a nickel, a dime to make for a packet. Very easy to treat, and yet still we're having hundreds and hundreds of people die from cholera because of lack of access to treatments that only cost pennies. Okay, well, switching gears, sticking to the climate change, but to a very different outcome, this from Medical Express. Warm days are contributing to gun violence surge across the U.S., a study of 100 cities. From Philadelphia to Portland, cities across the United States are experiencing spikes in gun violence on warm days. Researchers have begun to explore heat as a contributor to firearm violence, but current research on the subject is limited, focusing only on a few cities. Now, a new study by Boston University School of Public Health and the University of Washington School of Social Work provides a first-of-its-kind analysis of heat-attributable shootings as a nationwide problem. Published in the journal JAMA Network Open, the study found a consistent relationship between higher temperatures and higher risk of shootings in 100 of the country's most populated cities. The comprehensive study reveals that nearly 7% of shootings can be attributed to above-average daily temperatures, even after adjusting for seasonal patterns. The findings indicate that the Northeast and Midwest regions experience the sharpest increases in gun violence on hotter-than-normal days. Our study provides strong evidence that daily temperature plays a meaningful role in gun violence fluctuations, says study senior author Dr. Jonathan Jay, assistant professor of community health sciences at Boston University School of Public Health. Even though some regions show larger or smaller effects, the general pattern is remarkably consistent across cities. Gun violence is the leading cause of death among children and teens, and this violence has worsened substantially during the pandemic. As climate change threatens to raise daily temperatures even more, the researchers say these findings underscore the need for ongoing policies and programs that acclimate communities to heat and mitigate the risk of heat-attributable gun violence. So what could be driving this association between heat and gun violence? It could be that heat causes stress, which make people more likely to use aggression, Dr. Jay says. Or it could be that people are more likely to get out on warmer days and have more interactions, which creates more opportunity for conflict and violence. Most likely, it's a combination of both. Regionally, heat-attributable gun violence may be most pronounced in the Northeast and Midwest due to sharper fluctuations in temperature in those areas, even within seasons, or because cities in those regions are less acclimated to heat, the researchers say. But those regions are also more racially segregated than other areas of the country. The study findings should be interpreted within the context of structural racism and racial inequities in exposure to gun violence and heat, says Dr. Jay. The Northeast and Midwest regions are where we see some of the starkest differences in the built environment and other resources, according to race. To me, these inequities are the most interesting and important direction of this work, Dr. Jay says. We know that segregation and disinvestment leads communities of color, especially black communities, to have greater exposure to adverse environmental conditions that contribute to gun violence risk, such as abandoned buildings, liquor stores, lack of green space, and more intense urban heat islands. Health tree canopy and other heat mitigation strategies can serve as part of a mission that's part racial justice, part climate change mitigation, and part gun violence prevention, he says. These are all urgent issues where we need to continue to partner with communities and work across disciplines. The researchers will next study differences in heat-related gun violence among neighborhoods.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, now we've arrived at the segment of the show called Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. I'll give you the link at the end of the list. And this week we have tied the record for the number of bonus articles in a week at 26. So let's get to it. Bonus Article 1, How to Actually Enjoy the Holidays by Managing Stress and Anxiety. Hopefully the timing is good for that one. Article 2, How a Viral Siege is Making Some People Sick for Weeks, Even Months. Hopefully that's not your experience. But if it is, Article 3 might help. No one wants your cold. How to know if you're too sick to hang? the short answer to that is it's not easy, but this article might be helpful if you're trying to figure that out in the with holiday get-togethers. Article 4, Flu, RSV, and COVID are wreaking havoc, but teachers don't feel like they can stay home when they're sick. Even with paid sick leave, teachers, especially in elementary schools, say staying home creates more work. So it's just simpler to work through it. And of course, the elementary teachers are exposed to the kids that are the greatest incubators of viral and bacterial diseases. Next two articles get at a public health response that should be to help deal with that. Article 5, kids keep getting sick, overwhelming parents once again. Will the U.S. offer any help? And Article 6, paid sick leave is good for workers and U.S. public health. So this is something that I've reported on before, and it's a good example of how public policy and kind of our societal infrastructure can really make a difference. As individuals, it's overwhelming for parents to try to deal with all this infectious disease, but if you had good sick leave policies and such, it could go a long ways to making that easier for parents and everybody else who has to live in the viral soup. Article 7, How Medicare Advantage Plans Dodge Auditors and Overcharge Taxpayers by Millions. So I've done a lot of coverage on the disadvantage of Medicare Advantage plans. This is just another case study in that. But some good news on that front. Article 8, Biden administration proposes crackdown on scam Medicare ads to get at some of the worst aspects of those ads. And in more public policy news, Article 9, Biden administration extends pandemic area flexibilities on opioid use treatments. So during the pandemic, for instance, like when you went to get methadone, you actually had to go to a facility every single day to get your pill. Now they give out small quantities, like a week's supply or something. They're allowing this type of flexibility, which is shown to be just as safe and effective as the more restrictive measures. So we've learned something and improved and fortunately able to extend these pandemic era flexibilities, hopefully indefinitely. Article 10, is legislation to safeguard Americans against superbugs a boondoggle or breakthrough? So this is referring to that Pasteur Act that I reported on last week and the week before, I think, which is basically trying to get at antibiotic-resistant superbugs. And it's basically to create more incentives for creating new antibiotics. Now, this is a good example of the best way to get rid of the superbugs is to not produce the superbugs in the first place, which is largely overuse of antibiotics, either in healthcare or in livestock production. But it's sort of like the example of like the difference between like universal healthcare versus Obamacare. Obamacare expands healthcare a lot and gives health insurance to millions and millions of people, but it comes at a great cost by reinforcing for-profit, market-based healthcare. So with the superbugs and antibiotic resistance, this type of bill, this Pasteur Act, might actually increase the ability to deal with it by creating new antibiotics, but it might also be a giveaway to pharmaceutical companies. So you pay the price in that way. Article 11. U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends PrEP for HIV prevention. So you've probably seen the ads on TV for that. This was given the highest grade, grade A from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force for being effective and a high level of evidence. It's another example, though, of kind of a pharmaceutical success being part of the problem in the sense that this is very expensive treatment. Highly effective, but very expensive. So it's treatment is always more expensive than primary prevention. Although this one is kind of a combination because you treat with a drug to bring your viral levels so low that you can't transmit it to another person. So it's kind of that interface between prevention and treatment. But it requires an expensive drug. And in a somewhat related story with an infectious disease, hepatitis C, Article 12, hundreds of incarcerated people are dying of hep C even though we have a simple cure. So this is another one where you've got a cure that costs tens of thousands of dollars, relatively easy to administer, particularly if you, quote, have a captive population like incarcerated folks, but they're not getting treatment. This is particularly ironic since it's kind of doubly ironic because one of the ironies is that in the U.S., the only place in the United States where you have a constitutional right to health care is when you're incarcerated by the state. But there's no guarantees that the quality of that healthcare will be any good. This is also a series of like four articles from STAT. So if you're interested in this type of story, go to this article and you can get access to the other three articles. Article 13, people in rural areas die at higher rates than those in urban areas from every one of the top 10 leading causes of death. So I've reported on this with COVID a lot, but it's actually true just because rural and urban areas are very different. And this is part of the growing divide in our society between sort of red states or red areas and blue states, whether it's states or urban versus rural. And in drilling down on a more specific health issue, Article 14, states with more abortion restrictions have higher maternal and infant mortality. In those states with abortion restrictions, the maternal death rates are 62% higher than those with without major abortion restrictions. And another abortion article 15, focusing on exceptions misses the true harm of abortion bans. And in my reporting has probably played into this a little bit because I've covered a lot about the myriad of ways of lack of exceptions and the way that things are implemented that add to the additional harm of abortion bans. But it can be a little bit misleading, and this editorial is by the Guttmacher Institute is actually making the point that the overwhelming harm that abortion bans have is by being a ban in the first place. So the overwhelming majority of women are not able to access abortion. That's where the harm happens. It's not simply at the edges, like providing care for miscarriages and that type of thing. Okay, Article 16, more about women's health. From heart disease to IUDs, how doctors dismiss women's pain. A good long read about that and something many women will be intimately familiar with. Article 17, drug companies must address chronic neglect of women globally, says new report. So this is really talking about the fact that the pharmaceutical industry worldwide, while it may not even be as good as developing pharmaceutical cures for women as men, there's a huge divide between the developed countries and the lower income countries. And this is true particularly around women's health. So if you're talking about reproductive contraceptive services like oral contraceptives and that type of thing, the translation and different treatments for women health things are far less accessible outside of richer countries. Well, let's have one article for the men here. Number 18, how to get more men to try therapy. One solution is to convince them that asking for help is a strength, not a weakness. So this is kind of a classic thing that's been true for a long time, is that men are just as not as good of help seekers as women are. And this is to the detriment of their health and others, those around them. And in a somewhat related article, Article 19, suicidal thoughts are often hidden. Here's how to talk about it. It's related to the men's health because 80% of suicides are committed by men. And this article will go into depth about strategy about how to talk about suicidal thoughts if you suspect that those around you may be thinking such thoughts. Article 20, Parkinson's incidence 50% higher than previously thought. So this is just a good example that you need good epidemiology, the distribution of diseases. You need to study that in order to be able to track it and respond appropriately and proportionately. Okay, a couple articles around toxic chemicals. Article 21, 6 reasons the U.S. is losing the fight to ban toxic chemicals. I wish this was a shorter article. I would have reported the whole article, but this is a great one to read. And to drill down to one specific example, this is a ProPublica that's published these two articles. Article 22, as workers battle cancer, the government admits its limit for a deadly chemical is too high. This is something that's been going on for decades, where the regulatory limits have prevented public health from preventing easily preventable deaths. Article 23, a good long read, lessons for the next resistance. Veterans of the EPA faced unprecedented attacks under Donald Trump. We banded together and did something about it. So this is a good one for you social justice advocates and people that may be part of a bureaucracy, for instance, in the government, banding together to make sure that these worst attacks on regulation, in this case of the EPA, don't come to fruition. And in a very interesting long read, Article 24, how food became a weapon in America's culture war. First came the politics of right-wing grievance, then came the new foodie culture. Together they combined to create one toxic food fight. So a very interesting read. And I want to finish off on a couple articles that can get a little bit more to your own personal behavior. One is just a reminder that exercise is good in virtually all circumstances. Exercise is medicine for cancer, and every dose counts, even in late stages of the disease. Exercise is one of the greatest preventions. I'd put diet and exercise as the two kind of pillars there for basic health promotion. And last but not least, for the holiday season, kindness can have unexpectedly positive results. That's true for all kindness, but specifically true for, quote, random acts of kindness. When people don't expect it, it has an even more profound effect. So treat each other well, even strangers, during this holiday season. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-